Live on Tape, Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. Here are your hosts, Tom and Charles.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Work in Progress. My name is Tom Alexander, and as always, I am joined by my good friend and podcast partner. It is Charles Epstein. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. Today, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Jeff Levenshurz, Managing Director and co-leader of Willis Towers Watson's North American Health Management Practice. And Jeff's an incredibly versatile guy, as you'll see when he comes on. Looking forward to discussing his work with Willis Towers Watson and the findings from their 2021 Employee Experience Survey. Not to be confused with the Jimi Hendrix Experience Survey.
Yeah, a little bit of a distinction there, I guess.
Yeah, which I'm sure is based, and this is a bad pun alert, Tom, based on extensive feedback.
Yes, I was going to say, who has more feedback?
Yeah.
Well, on that note, very much looking forward to Dr. Levenshurz, and we'll be speaking with him momentarily. Now this break, this is Work in Progress.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it, 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Must be some kind of way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief.
Dr. Jeff Levenshurz is Managing Director and co-leader of Willis Towers Watson's North American Health Management Practice, where he leads the development of intellectual capital and provides consultation to large employers to guide them in making strategic investments in the health and wellness of their employees. He's also an assistant professor at Harvard School of Public Health, and he speaks to us today from Boston. Jeff, welcome.
Very nice to get to talk with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. Please say hi to my podcast partner, Charles Epstein.
Hi, Charles. Nice to speak with you as well.
Oh, same, Jeff. Several months back, we had on as our guest Dr. Carol Vallone Mitchell, who at that point was without question our most eclectic guest, a former molecular biologist, patent holder, co-founder of a leadership development consulting firm, and author of a book that brought her to the attention of none other than Arianna Huffington. Tom, I think Jeff is a new standard bearer for eclecticism. Check this out. Mm-hmm. As an undergrad at BU, he studied medicine and English, was editorial page editor of the school newspaper, and an intern for the late Senator Paul Tsongas. Then he got his MD, and several years later, I suppose, just because he had some time on his hands, got an MBA from Columbia. So, Jeff, how does one person pack that much into one life?
For starters, my wife, people also ask me, I've had a lot of different jobs, and my wife describes it as, almost attention deficit disorder when it comes to jobs. I actually have an enormous number of interests. Also, I've been lucky enough to have, have an especially supportive family. So I feel lucky to have gotten to do a mid-career, MBA. I feel that doing education, once somebody has a substantial amount of business experience is actually really wonderful. And it and doing that actually reminded me that I just love the academic environment. And that's why I've been lucky enough to have various jobs that have supported me in continuing to play an academic role, too. And I think I think they're also substantially synergistic. So so I feel lucky to be able to do all these things. It's hard to back in.
Yeah, so productive ADD, that's an interesting oxymoron, if you put it that way. Sort of like disruptive innovation, in a sense, which we'll get to momentarily. Tell us a little bit about your day job at Towers Watson.
Well, you know, I mean, for employers in the United States, and that's very different than in other countries, healthcare tends to be the second most expensive cost after salaries. And employers very much would like to think of a way to offer, you know, good, meaningful healthcare coverage for their employees. But they also like to figure out a way to gain some competitive advantage by spending a little less than other parties do. So we have a long experience with employers looking hard to come up with a better way to deliver healthcare coverage. And honestly, I've been teaching a course called Managing Healthcare Costs at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health for 18 years now. And I suppose that's a good indication that maybe I shouldn't be teaching it because we've failed. But during that time, medical costs have close to tripled. And and clearly this is a crisis. On the flip side, employees very much value healthcare benefits, and employers very much want employees to be healthy and not be distracted by either healthcare problems or financial problems that come from healthcare problems, and be able to actually, you know, productively do their jobs. So we give advice about how to procure health insurance through, for instance, carriers, what kind of programs to offer, also how to evaluate those programs, and furthermore, how to get people to engage in the programs. Because if you offer a wonderful program and no one signs up, you know, it's like the tree falling in the forest with nobody listening. Does it make a sound?
Yeah.
Yeah. Your LinkedIn page lists a number of your specialties, which includes leadership, change management, behavioral economics, and disruptive innovation. We could spend the rest of our time on just these three topics. In fact, maybe even some spinoff shows. But let me ask you to define behavioral economics for our listeners. And how do you apply it in your work?
You know, there was traditional economic point of view that everybody is looking to maximize their own economic outcome. But it's become pretty clear, especially over the last three decades or so, that that's not really true. People don't. For instance, why do doctors go into child psychiatry when that leads to much lower incomes than, for instance, being a cardiac surgeon or being a gastroenterologist? Why do people work for the government when they could work in private enterprise? So people all the time make decisions which are not utilitarian in that they don't lead to maximum economic wealth. But it's not like people are simply unpredictable. Rather, we know that there are certain ways that our minds process information that lead us to make decisions which don't lead to the best economic outcome. And again, the best economic outcome isn't necessarily what everybody even wants. I mean, many people would rather a little bit of happiness than a little bit more wealth. So let me give you an example. We did a project for the World Economic Forum in 2017 on what we called at the time human-centric health. But the idea was, how can you use behavioral economic cues to help people have better health behaviors and therefore prevent non-communicable diseases, things like heart disease and lung disease and diabetes? And it turns out that there are a series, there are a series of things that many different actors can do, whether those are governments or whether those are not, NGOs, not-for-profits, whether those are companies. And so for instance, when companies are thinking about how to convince their employees to maintain better financial health by saving enough for retirement in a 401k, for instance, having a good default is very valuable. So having a default where if you don't make a change, you're putting 3 or 6% of your income into retirement means many more people will save much more than if the default is zero and you have to do something active. People tend to have a very serious present bias. So we like things today much more than we like things tomorrow. That's a bit of a challenge because, chocolate chip cookie today is really good. Obesity that comes from chocolate chip cookie, later on, it's bad, but it's far away. So we tend to discount it. In that sense, if we are thinking about using any kinds of incentives, it's best for those incentives to be very much right away, as opposed to something in the distance. Best for them to be independent rather than mixed into something else. And frankly, because we understand that intrinsic motivation is actually very, very powerful, we want to generally use extrinsic incentives, give people a check for $100 or something, give people a gift certificate to go out to eat. We want to use those for pretty simple, straightforward things, as opposed to trying to use them for much more complicated goals. And so we were able to put together a series of case studies of what governments, companies, not-for-profits were doing really throughout the world to use these general precepts of behavioral economics to help people increase their health. I mean, sometimes people might think that behavioral economics is about misleading people in some ways, and that's absolutely not true. Everything comes with a framework and in context. What we'd like to do is use context to help people make decisions that are really better for themselves and hopefully ultimately better for better for society as well.
Yeah, again, this whole area of behavioral economics, to Todd's point in his question, we can just on that topic alone have you back on and discuss that. It's such a fascinating area with all these, discussion of cognitive biases and some of these nudge tactics. And, as you say, sort of how do you balance intrinsic and extrinsic motivation? It's just such a fascinating topic. Yeah. And of course, how it applies to the workplace, but picking up another element of Tom's questions, one of your areas of focus, disruptive innovation, obviously the pandemic has been in itself a cause of great disruption. What do you see as a major disruptive innovation on the horizon, particularly in the area of mental health that may be under most people's radar?
Yeah. Well, first let me do a little bit of a definition around disruptive innovation. So obviously there are many things that disrupt, and just because something disrupts doesn't mean it's a disruptive innovation. But disruptive innovation was a very specific concept. It was really pioneered by Clay Christensen. He had come from the hardware industry. He was a longtime Harvard Business School professor. He happened to be a resident of my town. Our kids played basketball together. Wow. Which was a special pleasure, but the idea is that in general, whatever technology, whatever service is currently in use, is generally good enough for most people. But there might be some service or some technology, some product which is not nearly good enough for most people, but it's good enough for a small portion of the population, and that is a disruptive innovation. So it's by definition somewhat defective compared to what people generally are using. But over time, it gets better rapidly, and when it gets better to the point that it's good enough for most people, whatever the incumbent product or service was, tends to actually just become a niche product or go out of business altogether. So, for instance, Clay made his initial observations in the computer hardware business, and many companies that made mini computers, these room-sized computers, basically They rejected the disruptive innovation of laptops because they were not nearly as capable as these room size computers. Also, they were much cheaper, and so the amount of margin for a company at building laptops was going to be much lower than building mini computers. But over time, laptops got good enough that mini computers pretty much don't exist anymore. One can say that Uber and Lyft have done the same thing to the taxi industry. They initially weren't nearly as good because there weren't as many cars on the road, but over time they got good enough, and pretty soon it was much harder to run a conventional taxi business. In healthcare, ideas of disruptive innovation are, and in most places, that disruptive innovation generally is using some degree of technology and potentially also downshifting and using somewhat less skilled people. For instance, Uber drivers just happen to have a car as opposed to taxi drivers who might have been studying maps for years. On the other hand, but once everybody had Waze and Google Maps, who cared how good somebody was at how much expertise people had at knowing the entire city of London? In medicine, what we see is that people in mental health, for instance, can start out using chatbots rather than talking to a counselor, and then those chatbots can actually use technology to identify when it appears that somebody is in danger, and then essentially move them up to dealing with a human being, and also move them up to actually seeing somebody in person, or even going to an emergency room, or seeking emergency care. Elsewhere in medicine, using a physician assistant rather than a physician for things where physician assistants can do a perfectly good job. Using pharmacists, there's actually some really good evidence about using pharmacists to treat diabetes. Pharmacists are a disruptive innovation compared to physicians because there is less training involved and they're somewhat less expensive. But with good technology in the background, they can do a good job, and in some instances, maybe even a better job.
Yeah. By the way, I have about 5 questions, Jeff, but I'm not going to ask them so long as you agree to come on this show a little bit down the road so we can address some of those.
Sure.
Good. We have you on record.
Yeah, that would be great. Dr. Jeff Levenshurst is our guest, managing director and the co-leader of Willis Towers Watson's North American Health Management Practice. Your recently published 2021 Employee Experience Survey found more than 9 in 10 employers, that's 94%, said enhancing the employee experience will be an important priority at their organization over the next 3 years, compared to just 54% that indicated it was important to their organization prior to the pandemic. What are employees prioritizing when they indicate that they want to see an improved employee experience?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that that the labor market has changed substantially, and that employers are oftentimes having a hard time filling certain jobs, especially service jobs. For a long time, employers have been competing very vigorously for certain highly technical fields like software engineering and like certain fields in finance. I think that what employers are looking to do is they're looking to offer their employees an experience like their employees are used to getting from other services. So that, for instance, when we go on to Amazon to order, to order whatever we're ordering, we expect everything to work incredibly smoothly. And, on the flip side, I don't want to minimize how much work people at Amazon have done to be sure that I'm able to get something that I ordered 2 days later, being sure that that medical care works as smoothly is actually quite difficult. And so I think employers are pushing harder on carriers to offer good information to people, and also, you know, eventually to offer navigation and even concierge services. I think that employers are thinking about many employers are thinking about certain kind of perks that perhaps they didn't think about before. I think employers are also recognizing that employees actually have some demands that they weren't willing to talk about before. So, for instance, many employees that have been away from the workplace for 16 or 17 months now, they're liking not commuting. They're liking being home for dinner. And so I think employers are increasing, there are some employers that are saying, oh, of course, we want everybody back, especially those employers that are in the travel industry or that have big exposure to commercial real estate. But I think many employers are thinking twice about this. I mean, there's a book, Drive, by Daniel Pink, which states that what people really want out of work is autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Now, there's not every job in the world that can that can give you all those three things, but I think many employers are thinking harder about how to be sure that their employees can reach these. And whether it's autonomy by having fewer constraints about where you have to be when, whether it's mastery by giving people more opportunities for professional or for job advancement along the way, and whether it's purpose, there are more companies that are thinking about environment, social, and governance (ESG) and where they fit into this. And the Business Roundtable has started talking about the fact that companies have responsibilities beyond increasing shareholder wealth. And I think that for many employees, that actually substantially helps with a sense of purpose. So I think that there are a lot of really good things going on that will hopefully make work a better place in years to come.
Jeff, the coronavirus pandemic has caused a dramatic increase in mental health needs, especially depression and anxiety. As we mentioned at the top, one of your areas of focus is leadership. What are some of the forward-thinking initiatives leaders you've worked with? What are they doing to address the mental health needs of their employees?
The first thing is really the diagnosis, like what's going on and what's the problem. And I think that what we recognize is that there's been a huge access problem, and that huge access problem has been going on for a long time. Most counties in the country don't have a child psychiatrist. Most people, even in metropolitan counties like the one I live in the Boston area, even if there are lots of child psychiatrists, good luck getting an appointment with one of them. There's been a huge access problem, and we really need to address that. So child has been a big problem. The other big problem has really been in substance use, where I think that last year there were 90,000 people who died of drug overdose things, and getting access to medication assisted treatment, which really really works, has been hard. There's also really been a long-term underpayment of mental health professionals, which has led to a real shortage in the field, and has also led many employers find that a huge portion of their employees who do get mental health services end up getting them out of plan. So the first thing that leaders are doing is they're looking hard at the data to see that there's a problem. Then the next thing they're doing is they're starting to put in place solutions, but they're doing them while measuring too. So one of the approaches has been to essentially really extend what employee assistance programs offer. So traditional employee assistance programs might offer sort of telephone triage and, you know, 3 or 5 visits. They're often telephonic. So there's been an expansion of that. I think many companies are recognizing that it's good to have many different on-ramps into mental health services. So those on-ramps could start out with something which is purely digital, where you're putting information in, getting it out. Technology might be doing that, AI, as opposed to actual real people, might involve some coaches, might involve texting to virtual, where we're moving away from people actually having to physically go to an office and instead doing it, via video conference, something very, very much like Zoom. Giving people many different ways to get into mental health care is actually really important, but it's going to also be important to measure how all this works. And we have to measure how many services are delivered. We also have to measure whether people are genuinely getting better because they're getting more mental health services. So I think that, that's what we see. And it's not just a problem for employees. I think that's a really important point. It's also a huge problem for dependents. Both child psychiatry and psychology needs and mental health and substance abuse needs are actually very common amongst dependents, but the impact that has on employees and their ability to work productively is really substantial, and the impact that it has on employee well-being is really substantial.
Yeah. You mentioned employee well-being and, of course, extending to their dependents. But I also think that this pandemic has illuminated the need for leaders themselves who are not exempt from the stressors and so forth, having to make their way through this pandemic. Many of them are working from home. And again, they're not exempt from those domestic pressures. So I'm assuming this is really, maybe it's made mental health services an easier sell to leaders who previously might have been a little bit more resistant to it. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's a fair statement. I also think that in some instances we see leaders who are more willing to step up and talk about the impact that that mental health challenges have had on themselves. And right. Because obviously, there's been a huge problem of stigma, and when we see that leaders are willing to acknowledge that they too are subject potentially to feeling lonely and isolated, subject to depression, maybe they're in remission, but have had issues with substance use. That's actually something, which can be very valuable. We need to create create social cues that let people get the care that they need. And I think leaders can play a really important role in that.
Yeah, indeed.
One last question. Are there any more advanced degrees in your future?
I'm probably beyond getting more advanced degrees, but I don't know, perhaps in retirement, but I think that being around a bunch of smart students is a way of getting an education in and of itself.
Yeah
Certainly keeps you young and connected.
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate your time today. It was illuminating, that's for sure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Great. Well, thanks for the opportunity. Great to talk to both of you.
Our guest was Dr. Jeff Levin-Schurz, Managing Director and the co-leader of Willis Towers Watson's North American Health Management Practice, where he leads the development of intellectual capital and provides consultation to large employers. He spoke to us today from Boston. This is Work in Progress. Back in a moment.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it, 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Wrapping things up now on Work in Progress, along with Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. Wow, a lot to unpack there, Charles. That was very, very interesting.
Yeah, I guess it's a lot to be said for what I was calling a productive ADD.
Yes.
Yeah. A pretty accomplished guy, definitely uses both sides of his brain, which I can't say for all of us.
No. Yeah, exactly. For those of us just trying to use one side.
Yeah, or a quarter of one side. Yeah. You know, we for the most part be ahead of the game. But yeah, he touched on so many interesting things, disruptive innovation. That was a really good explanation. People think of disruptive innovation as a technology that hits like an atom bomb. It comes out of nowhere and blows everything up. But you know, as he said, it's more stealthy and evolutionary before it becomes revolutionary, sort of like Hemingway's description of going bankrupt. It happens gradually, then suddenly.
Yeah, yes. That's very true. I've heard that story from more than one person.
Yes, yes. Up close and personal.
Yeah, yeah. It's like bankruptcy 101.
Yeah, and behavioral economics, man, such a fascinating subject. In fact, we spoke with him after we stopped recording for a good 15 minutes on that topic alone. We need to have him on again to talk just about that. We do have him on record as saying he will come back. So there's no way of getting out of that.
Right. Can't undo it.
Yeah.
You don't get a mulligan on that one.
No. And, you know, just last thing, Tom, you know, I think he really put his finger, you know, when he really got into talking about mental health on what I think is really important, different modes of access for mental health services, which, you know, not only makes it more available for people where it otherwise is not, but it removes the stigma if you can access it after hours through an app. And then, of course, he talked about the importance of leadership and modeling behavior vis-a-vis being more upfront about their mental health issues. All of that's really, really important. And, you know, as companies transition to new ways of work, and I do recommend that 2021 employee experience survey, a lot of really interesting findings.
Very interesting. And we really do appreciate Dr. Jeff Levenshurst joining us today on Work in Progress. For Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. We thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.
This has been Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between, with award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. For more, visit worldatwork.org/workinprogress. That's worldatwork.org/workinprogress. Join us next week for another edition of Work in Progress.